Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we are spending the whole hour with Tampa Bay Times reporter Kelly Benham and her husband, Tom French.
And the story that they're telling us?
It's about this limbo. A space that's literally between life and death.
We have to tackle some really big questions.
Yeah.
Although here's an easy one. Tom, when did you decide to name your daughter Juniper?
About 5 days after she was born.
Now, in those 5 days, pretty much everything in their lives changed. I mean, on the most superficial level, they began their hospital stay day zero in the maternity ward, which had butterflies on the walls and
images of roses opening. <You know? laughs> And everyone's really good looking.
Like in an ER sort of way? Or
like in a Grey's Anatomy kind of way. We had like one super hot nurse. We called her Cupcake. And she had this like glossy hair. And, you know, people would visit me and they'd be like, hey, is Cupcake here? When is Cupcake coming by?
And so that's where their hospital journey began. But 5 days later, everything had changed, and they find themselves on a different floor of the hospital, stranded in this unit that is perhaps more than any other place on Earth, the physical embodiment of this limbo, the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU, where they just have to wait and hope that that will, or whatever it was they saw in Juniper, takes hold.
We had been, like, yanked out of our lives and out of everything that we recognized, you know, out of our jobs, out of our house. And we just been dropped into this, like, science fiction. Nothing was recognizable. The babies didn't even look like babies, you know? There was one baby that had his intestines, you know, outside of his body, like, piled up on his belly, like, in this bag. And everyone's wearing a uniform. Don't know who anyone is. And everything's like beeping and humming and you don't know how long you're going to be there and you don't have any sense of time. Like, day and night don't mean anything and, you know, we're sort of dimly aware of the sun rising and setting out the window. But other than that, it's just like minute to minute, hour to hour. You're afraid to leave even for an hour to get some lunch because the baby could die.
You know, if we went home to get some sleep, would she die?
I mean, it's that critical.
And she had roughly 5-6 days that went pretty well. And then that next weekend,
she blew a hole in her intestines.
That was the real beginning of a lot of problems.
And her belly turned dark and got real distended.
They were inserting drains
in the belly
to try to drain away
the stool and gunk. And she just had this little straw sticking out of her belly.
And then they couldn't maintain her blood pressure. So I was thinking of everything I could do, because you don't want to feel powerless in a situation like that. You want to feel like there's something you can do.
So in quiet moments, what Tom would do?
Chapter one. The boy who lived.
Is he would stand over Juniper's incubator and he would read her Harry Potter.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious. As I started reading to her, and as the days went on, she has no idea what I'm reading, right?
Right.
But there is something there that she responded to. I wanted to say she liked, because her sat number would go high at that point.
Her sat number, what is it, like her oxygen?
The saturation of oxygen in her blood.
Tom says that number on the monitor was one of the only ways that they could get feedback about how she was doing, because, you know, her eyes were still closed. There'd be times when she wasn't moving around a lot. The higher the number, the better. And he says when he would read to her, her numbers would go up.
Not just slowly, but instantly. But then when I got deeper into the story, I read in Hagrid's voice, "Borrowed it, Professor Dumbledore, sir," said the giant, climbing carefully off the motorcycle as he spoke. And she desatted instantly.
And the alarms were just going off and going off and going off.
And Kelly hit me and she said, "You're scaring the baby." And I'm like, what? You could see, even before her eyes opened, that she was really responding to what we were doing. She didn't know what a chapter is, but she was, in her own way, very eagerly waiting for the next chapter. And I don't know a better way to describe wanting to be alive than you want to find out what happens next.
Unfortunately, what happens next is that
one night at around 2 o'clock in the morning,
on a rare night that they actually went to sleep at home, they get a call from their doctor.
And his first question was, "How far do you live from the hospital?" And, you know, that's not a question you want to hear from your child's doctor.
We, like, rushed to the hospital. And
when they get there, they were told
that she did it again. She got another hole. Another hole in her intestines. And she started to really spiral and really go downhill.
Her blood pressure and oxygen levels were crashing.
She was on 100% oxygen. The ventilator settings were turned up as high as they could go, and she was still struggling and faltering. And, you know, once they are giving your baby 100% oxygen, they can't give her any more.
At that point, I had done everything that I could possibly do.
This is Fauzia Shakil,
neonatologist at All Children's Hospital.
She was Juniper's doctor at the time. She says she'd given Juniper everything she could think of, blood pressure medicine, antibiotics. She'd put a drain in her abdomen.
But obviously it was not enough.
Something was wrong.
Terribly wrong.
We might lose her at any second.
The only option left?
To take her to the operating room and cut her open.
Clear the intestines, relieve the pressure.
How do you do a surgery on a 1-pound baby? It seems...
No, exactly. I mean, you don't.
She was so extremely premature. So fragile.
So tiny that operating seemed kind of crazy. And Dr. Shakil began to really consider the idea that maybe this was it.
And at that point, I was at bedside looking at her.
Trying to figure out what to do.
And all of a sudden,
she opened her eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
She opened her eyes
wide.
And she looked at us.
Her eyes were like wide open. And she was looking right at the doctor.
Directly.
Staring at her hard.
And it was a very powerful moment.
Dr. Shakil says she decided right then and there, we're going to surgery.
I think she deserves a chance.
Tell me more about why you made that decision.
Well, typically babies who are that critical, they are totally unresponsive.
Yeah.
Because they're just fighting for every breath, and the ability to just open her eyes at that stage in her life, when she had no blood pressure that I could barely record, when she had hardly any oxygen, for her to just open her eyes and look at us, it was a very powerful statement that I'm still here.
I'm here. I am still here.
Don't give up.
So Dr. Shakil summoned the pediatric surgeon, told her they want to move forward with the operation, but the surgeon said,
no.
The surgeon was adamant that she did not want to do it.
She said it's futile, and her blood pressure is so unstable that she will not make it out of the OR.
And the surgeon told her, even if I can open her up and do the job, her skin is so papery that I might not be able to sew her back up.
There are guidelines that medical industries have, even basic things like the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm.
That's law professor and ethicist Nita Farahani again.
Many physicians legitimately believe that if you have a preterm infant and that infant is in serious peril of spending a life of suffering and pain,
then the only way to do no harm and fulfill your oath is not to do the surgery.
But
she says, if you ask the courts,
you know, right now, the law favors life.
The courts have seen very few cases that involve disputes like this, but in every one so far, she says, they've supported the person who's arguing to keep the child alive.
Whenever there's life, there's hope. So this is our window. We should do it now.
For Dr. Shakil, the argument that ultimately won the day was simply this.
Basically, what I told her was that if you think she's going to die...
Well?
She is dying right now, as we speak in the unit.
So we can either do nothing and she definitely dies, or we can do something and she probably dies, but you never know.
There is a slim chance.
So they're wheeling the incubator with the baby in it, and we've, you know, I'm holding her little hand, and she's getting ready to go into surgery, and she was looking right at me, and she hadn't done that before. I mean, it really seemed like she was aware that I was there very clearly, and she was locked on my face. So I leaned over, I gave her a little kiss on her forehead, and Tom did the same thing, and then they wheeled her away.
How long was the operation?
It was... They paged us much more quickly than we expected to come back, so we knew something was wrong.
A nurse ushered Tom and Kelly into a separate room.
This little windowless conference room, and the surgeon came in, and she said, you know, she was supposed to go in and clean everything out and rinse everything off and find the hole and patch it and do all these things. And she said when she cut the baby open and touched the baby's intestines with her little probe, the way she described it was everything fell apart. It was just falling apart and falling apart.
And you're hearing this?
Yeah.
Juniper had survived the operation, but barely.
So we're thinking, like, okay, this was an incredibly risky surgery, and we just put her through it for nothing. And I thought there was no way the baby was going to live till morning.
I'd been really working hard to avoid thinking about all the bad things that were possibly going to happen here, and just trying to hold on, you know, and I sort of thought it was my job to do that. And it's kind of funny. Kind of stereotypically male of me.
And Tom says they were in the car around the time of the surgery.
As we're driving, you know, by that time, Junebug and I were about 2/3 of the way through the first book. And this thought just snuck in on me, which was, what if I don't get to finish reading her this book? What if she doesn't get to hear the ending? And, you know, she never finds out, you know, what happens to Harry and Hermione and Ron. That thought led in all the other thoughts, very difficult thoughts about all the things we wouldn't get to do with her, that she would never get to know. And I had this terrible thought that, you know, she was in this incubator, this isolate, this plastic box, and I had this terrible thought that she was just going to go from one box to another. And I had to pull over, you know, because I just lost it. And at that point, I wasn't maintaining anymore. There was no holding back this flood of what was happening. And we had a rule, Kelly and I, which was that only one of us got to lose it at a time. And, you know, that was my turn to lose it.
We're in a very unnatural situation of neonatal intensive care, which is so recent in the developed world and still doesn't exist in much of the world. And working so hard to save babies is very new.
Neonatologist Keith Barrington.
In evolutionary history, newborn babies very frequently died. And most parents who have any significant number of children had lost one or two or three or more. And in order to be able to carry on with your life and to provide for the rest of your family, we had to be able to adapt to the death of babies. And now that it's become much less common to lose a baby, even, you know, miscarriages and stillbirths, so now we're realizing how much that hurts. And in the past, maybe we've hidden some of that from ourselves.
No way the baby was going to live till morning. But what happened was really strange. She continued to just not die. And the next day, she, you know, she was still there. The surgeon was surprised, and
no one could quite explain it.
The more I thought about it, the more I found it, like, surprising and interesting, you know, because she doesn't know that there's a better place, you know, but she's just in this box.
Yeah.
And she's got needles coming out of every which way and a tube down her throat. She has no idea that one day, you know, she'll just be held and rocked and we'll take her out for ice cream and she'll play with the dog. And I just wondered, like, what is she fighting for? So that became, you know, our job. The best that we could articulate it was to try to give her some sense of something beyond that place.
After the surgery, things did not get easier.
She would stop breathing many times a day. Teams would rush in to
say, "Come on, Jimbo, come back, come back." I remember the room spinning.
And then
she started to swell for like weeks and weeks.
But she continued
to not die.
And she began to gain weight.
And, you know, nurses are very superstitious, a lot of them. They won't say the word home.
For some reason, when the babies hear that word.
This is Tracy Hullett again, primary nurse.
They get sick, and we just, it's a superstition, obviously, but something happens, and sometimes it can be devastating.
So what do you say instead?
We'll say that place that the baby's going to go when they leave here.
Wow, my God, that's so tortured.
Sometimes we spell it, which makes no sense at all.
But after about 4.5 months, Diane, that nurse practitioner, told us that we might want to think about buying a car seat. That was the first inclination that we might be able to take her out of there.
That's the first time I've ever imagined a choir of angels singing around mention of car seat.
Car seats, right? But when you want to have a baby really bad and everybody else has a baby but you and you can't have a baby, things like shopping for car seats become like fantasies, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and finally, you know, the doctor gave the all clear and we took the monitors off of her and she was completely free and untethered, not hooked to anything. And we strapped her into this car seat and I put a little pair of sunglasses on her, because I didn't know if her eyes would be okay in the sunlight. She'd never seen the sun.
Wow.
And we all kind of walked out, and Tracy's really not a hugger, but we like grabbed her and hugged her and cried and all over her shirt. And then we put the baby in the car and we went to Chick-fil-A.
We went to Chick-fil-A.
Yeah. That was totally before the gay thing and before I stopped going to Chick-fil-A.
And all in all, how long were you in the hospital for?
6.5 months. It was 196 days.
How is Juniper now? What is... Can you give us a snapshot of her morning?
Sure.
Actually, Tom and Kelly were nice enough to allow us to send a reporter to their house to meet her.
Good morning.
Good morning.
She's 2 years old now.
Hi, good morning. Junebug. Good morning, Junebug.
That's Jennifer.
This is Miss Jennifer.
Say hi.
When we got there, she was still in bed. It was just waking up.
She's not being very cuddly this morning. Or snuggly.
But then she just sprung up, jumped out of bed, and took off.
Daddy's.
Yeah, he went to Daddy. Is that funny? Come on. Show me where the kitty is. I know you want to give the kitty a hug. Shh, easy. Don't. Nice hug.
She's kind of your typical two-year-old.
Gentle.
And because we were there, Juniper felt it was kind of important that we see some tricks she's learned.
Oh!
Yay! Perfect!
Good summer songs.
You know what, though?
this is radio, so they have no idea what you just did.
Good somersaults.
You know, it's interesting because as journalists, again, we spend a lot of time chronicling sometimes very terrible things. And what's interesting is that yesterday morning, by journalistic standards, nothing happened.
You know what we need to do is change your diaper.
It was wouldn't even be on journalistic radar. You forgot about it. But what you know as a parent.
Here, come see mommy.
Especially after you've been through what we went through.
If you come see mommy, I'm gonna kiss you.
Was everything happened.
I'm gonna kiss you. There's nothing you can do about it either. Are you ready? One.
Everything happened yesterday in that couple hours. The entire world was contained inside that morning.
Can I have Eskimo kisses?
And all of her, all the blank chapters of her life were inside that morning, waiting to be written.
Which one? You want this book? Come here.
And this book is called All. And do you feel like you're out of the woods?
Well,
both Tom and Kelly said, no way. And then Tom told us about these flu shots that Juniper gets.
They're not just flu shots. They're like flu shots, like super flu shots. And there's four shots you get. And I swear to God, they cost $14,000 for those four shots. And
that's a real number you just said?
That's a fact. That's Jeez. A fact. They are designed to help protect her from RSV.
Which is a virus that in most people just presents as a common cold.
But, you know, her lungs are still recovering and are still developing, and RSV can be devastating.
And there are some other concerns that could still creep in down the road. Some studies have shown that kids who are born prematurely struggle more in school with reading and math, that often they're more susceptible to depression and anxiety.
But I will say that we took her to visit a preschool the other day. And we took her there and set her down, and she just took off and like went up to these giant children and started taking their toys, and they were singing The Wheels on the Bus, and you could see it in her eyes. I know that song. And she didn't care about Tom or I one bit. You know, she was totally there with those kids, and she was so ready. And I thought, wow, like she might be okay. She is okay.
In case you're wondering, Keith Barrington, the neonatologist we spoke to earlier, when we asked him how his daughter is doing, out of curiosity, how is Violette doing now?
She's great. She's coming to the end of her first grade in school, and she's perfect.
So we should say these are two stories of babies who made it. But in this brand new frontier, of course, there are many stories of babies who don't.
A big thank you to All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida, for letting us talk to pretty much everybody and
record the sounds of their yes. NICU. And thank you, huge thank you to Matthew Kilty for production help on this story and many late nights.
And we also recommend that if you can, you should take a look at Kelly Benham's articles. It's a series of articles that ran in the Tampa Bay Times. And we have linked to it on our website. So if you want to read the very beautiful version of what we've just told you, it's all there waiting for you.
Radiolab.org. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Tracy Hullett. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters,
Jim Howard, Brenna Farrell,
Molly Webster, Melissa O'Donnell, Dylan Keefe, Lynn Levy, and Andy Mills.
With help from Matt Kilty, Kelsey Padgett, and Megan Tam.
Special thanks to Lynn Paltrow, Jennifer Dronkers, and John Lantos.
End of message. Goodbye.